and welcome to another edition of Kaleidoscope. This is Magda Zenon, recording from downtown Nicosia. And with me in the virtual studio, I have Maya Tabbitt. Welcome, Maya.
Thanks, Magda.
Maya, I looked over your CV, and the only part that I could clearly pick out of who Maya is your love of words. You started off as a reporter, but now you do mainly translations and editing. The floor is yours to introduce yourself to the listeners.
Thanks, Magda. Okay, so I'm a literary translator, and I translate modern Arabic fiction into English. I do translate other kinds of creative writing, not necessarily fiction, but my specialty, if you will, is literary work. I don't anymore do, UN documents. I used to. And editing, yes, I started out when I was very young as a rookie reporter with no experience. I was just sort of hired, in a random kind of way.
And the best kind of way, actually.
And I quickly distinguished myself, quote unquote, because of my native command of English. Mm-hmm. And so I was asked to do more editing than writing. And so I became an editor. And then the last 10 years, I was the associate editor of an academic journal based in the United States. And that really, really, honed my academic editing skills, which I now also use in a freelance capacity because I'm no longer with that journal.
The other thing that also characterizes your CV is the traveling you've done, because you're Lebanese-born, mm-hmm. but you've lived in the U.S., in Cyprus, in Pakistan, in New Delhi, in Islamabad, in Nairobi. I ran out of the place, but you've traveled a lot, and I'm always quite envious of people that travel. Not that I haven't traveled in my life, but I think it is such a gift to be able to have lived in different places in the world. I think it, in one way, it makes you an island, but mm-hmm. in another way, it makes you so much richness. It adds so much to who you are and who you bring to the place and who you ultimately take away. So, tell me.
I agree. I'm interested and curious about your description of it as being an island.
An island because I'm also a traveler in a way, because I'm a child of the diaspora. Mm-hmm. Cypriot diaspora, born and brought up in South Africa, in the apartheid, times of apartheid. So in the times of apartheid that actually put us into communities. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to Greece, and then I spent time in the States, and then I came here. But I think when I think of myself as an island, it's not as an insular island. It's actually, the island is me in my authenticity, in what I bring with me and how I grow. But it's me as a Greek island. There are a lot of little other islands around me, so I'm not lonely. I'm not lonely.
I'm glad you clarified that, because it's interesting, that's the metaphor you used for you. And the metaphor I would use for me is that I think of myself, being a global nomad, as the, current phrase is. I think of myself more as a bridge than an island.
Okay.
So wherever I go, I'm spanning differences and sometimes isolations and lack of knowledge, and so I feel that I'm like a hyphen. So I feel more hyphenated than anything else. And yes, it's part of my trajectory. I guess it's not really explainable, but I started this. Nomadism started when I was very young. My parents divorced when I was 11, which was very unusual in Lebanon of the 60s. And my mother remarried a British diplomat who was at the time posted in India. And hence, and because my mother and father had an amicable divorce and my father granted my mother custody, which was also unusual, we children ended up in New Delhi. And that was literally, almost literally mind-blowing for me. You know, I came from, you know, Beirut is a fairly sophisticated and cosmopolitan Levantine city. But, you know, going to New Delhi and being part of an expatriated community of Brits and, you know, Americans and Sudanese and lots of people, whom we knew because my stepfather was a diplomat. And then, you know, discovering India in as much as I did. I mean, obviously, India is very big and I was very little and I didn't travel, obviously, by myself. But it was just a
mind-blowing.
A fantastic experience. It was mind-blowing. It really was.
And how many years did you live in India?
2 years. And it was enough to, you know, to be really struck and stunned. And then I went from there to England because the stepfather person decided he wanted to go back to England. And so we went along. And that was like an ice cold shower because I had come from this warm, diverse,
the brilliance of color,
various state, you know, place with lots of color and, you know, and
smells
suddenly,
and sounds.
Yes, and also acceptance, you know. And then suddenly I landed in England. This was late 60s and it was xenophobic. And even though I spoke English perfectly well, people were xenophobic. And I felt it very much, even as a 13-year-old who didn't know much about, you know, politics or didn't know much about history. I mean, I had no preconceived notions. But I found England cold and the British, you know, it wasn't my cup of tea. So after 3 years, I left. And it was my first experience of xenophobia. I had never felt rejected or disliked or looked down on until I arrived in the UK. And this is obviously pre-European Union UK.
So yes, of course.
The UK was a lot more insular and...
colonial, perhaps?
I don't know if it was colonial, but it still there were still vestiges of the hardships of the Second World War. It wasn't a place of abundance, you know.
Okay.
India was abundant. Lebanon was abundant. I had been to Cyprus on a holiday with my father when I was 12, you know, and we'd been to Famagusta, and this was before the, you know, the invasion, the Turkish invasion. So all the places that I'd been... which weren't many at the time, but, you know, I'd been to Syria, obviously Lebanon, India, and Cyprus. And they were all places that looking back, had this commonality, which was that they were abundant, and England was not. It was a place of scarcity, of scarce emotions, of scarce warmth, of scarce respect, you know. And it was really hard. So I went back to Lebanon.
On your own?
Yeah, after 3 years, I left my mother and my brothers and I went back to my dad's house. And so I went back to live with my dad's family. And then the war happened and, you know, lots and lots of things happened. And I ended up engaged/married to... an American man who, though he was born and raised in Beirut by parents who had been at the American University of Beirut since, before 1948, before the Nakba, before the creation of the State of Israel, things got very, very hard during the war. And he, because he looked like a foreigner, his life was in jeopardy. And so we left. And he worked at the time with an international aid organization, and they sent us to Yemen. So off we went to Yemen.
You stayed in the area. You stayed in the area.
Yes, and so on and so forth. And from Yemen, we came to Cyprus, and from Cyprus, we went to Pakistan, and eventually, we made our way to the United States, where I lived for a quarter of a century.
And I'll take you back to what I spoke about earlier, this question of identity. Mm-hmm. How does your identity fit into all these moves? What do you identify as? And I know identity is not one dimension and it's not one. We wear a lot of hats. But I think traveling or moving around affects certain parts of our identity and reinforces other parts of our identity.
Yes, that is very true. I think my traveling has reinforced my identity as an Arab. I wasn't aware of being, you know, when I left Lebanon at 11 and when I went to England when I was 13, I didn't identify as an Arab. You know, I wasn't politicized. I was Lebanese and I spoke Arabic.
And French.
And French, yes. And my mother was from a generation whose Arabic was very poor because they were sent to French schools where they were punished for speaking Arabic and Arabic was disdained.
Looked down upon.
French. What's that?
It was looked down upon by the French.
Yes, it was looked down upon, and my mother didn't have a command of Arabic, whereas my father did. So, you know, in a way, you know, the moving around when I was young forged my identity as an Arab. I really understood when I got to England that I wasn't like those people, and I really understood what white superiority and supremacy meant. And even though I pass as white, you know, in terms of my phenotype, if you look at me, you know, you wouldn't know. But racism isn't about your skin color, you know.
Oh, absolutely not. I agree. Having lived in South Africa during the years of apartheid, I might have been classified as white, but I was an immigrant.
Yeah.
I was the child of immigrants, and the racism was rampant.
Yeah. So I felt like that. So the UK and British culture sort of were a crucible for that identity. But at the same time, and paradoxically, and it's always been a tension that I have felt, the UK and the Indian Odyssey meant that I switched my education and my main language from French to English. And I learned to love the English language and to really thrill to it in those years. So it was a really complicated relationship because I became very adept linguistically in a language that represented a people who, to me, felt
cold,
inimical.
Okay.
And who looked down on me and to whom I always had to prove my credentials. And I resented that, of course. In the beginning, I kind of internalized my inferiority, the way that many immigrants and people who are not from the European metropole are, you know, they become colonized in their brains. They think that, you know, France or Europe or England or white people are better and that, you know, back home everybody is, you know, primitive or backward or superstitious or whatever it is. And that's an internalization of racism.
Absolutely.
And the colonial mentality.
And
so I never went there. I couldn't do it. I couldn't internalize this inferiority. But at the same time, I began to wield the language of my detractors so well that it created a real tension inside me. And then when I went back to Lebanon as a 16-year-old, I discovered that, you know, my native tongue was Arabic and that I didn't master it. And so I spent the rest of my life kind of making up for that huge gap. Mm-hmm. And I think I became a literary translator partly because when I read in Arabic, I am so moved by the beauty of the language that all I want to do is put it into English as if to show them, you know, this is how beautiful the culture I come from is. Why aren't you seeing me? Why aren't you seeing us? Why do you think we're savages or we're, you know, desert dwellers or, you know, some kind of inferior being? Look at this language and what it produces.
I can see why you did it. I mean, it's your bridge, bringing the two languages, the one to the other. So you bring the one culture to the other culture in a language that they understand. How did you ultimately end up in Cyprus? And how do you, because in Cyprus is also quite a racist community, as much as we don't want to believe it is.
Yes, I've noticed that now that I'm living here after, you know, I lived here 35 years ago with my family, with my very young family. I had my second child here. And at the time, there wasn't a person of color in Cyprus that I could see. There were no trend of having, you know, workers, domestic workers, and workers who do all sorts of menial jobs in Cypriot society, and who are all from, you know, the global south, and who are all persons of color. There was nobody like that. Mm. You know, the yayas were taken care of by their daughters-in-law. The gardens were taken care of by, you know,
The bapu
or some peasant who had a car and who came in from the rural areas. So my connection to Cyprus is actually quite interesting also, because first I told you I came to Cyprus when I was 12 and the island wasn't divided at the time. Mm. And we had a lovely holiday with my father and my brother. Then my first serious boyfriend at university was a Cypriot who had a Fulbright scholarship in Beirut. And so I came with him on all our academic vacations. And he and his family were refugees from the north, just over the Green Line. I mean, they came from a village that's, you know, 3 kilometers outside of Nicosia. And they had a difficult story because one of his brothers was disappeared and never returned and was in the army. And they took me in. They were my alternative family. I learned Greek. He taught me to read and to write, and he read poetry to me.
So did they teach you Greek or Cypriot, just out of curiosity?
No, he taught me Greek.
Okay.
Because he taught me to read and write, and so he taught me Greek. And, of course, when I came here, I, you know, saw that there were disparities between, you know, this and that. And then he and I traveled together in Greece as well, because he was simultaneously at Thessaloniki University. And so, you know, we were going back and forth between Lebanon and Cyprus and Greece. I became really, really good friends with his sister. And she and I are to this day friends, although, you know, he and I have long parted and never saw each other again. And I consider her like a sister because I have no sister. And so when I came, when my husband and I finished, when he finished his job in Yemen, we were desperate to return to Lebanon. But Lebanon was still in pretty bad shape. The war hadn't ended. And so the closest thing to Lebanon and, you know, the most Lebanon adjacent place was Cyprus. So we came here. And he got a part-time job with a Lebanese nonprofit based in Limassol, and he got another part-time job with another nonprofit based here in Nicosia. And we had a second baby, and, you know, we lived here for almost 4 years. So I really became rooted here in a way, I'd like to say. And a little extra twist to my story, which is that my mother came from a Hellenophile Syrian family.
Okay.
So my mother spoke Greek. My godmother spoke Greek. My maternal grandmother was Yaya to me, even though okay. I only met her once. So there was Greek in my, you know, in me.
Yeah, there's a conversation in Greek as well, in your head.
Yes, and so when I came, and I loved Greek when I learned to read and write it, when my ex-boyfriend, my former boyfriend, taught me to read and write. I loved it, and I loved listening to him reading poetry by Seferis and Kavafis, and, you know, so I knew it was something that was sort of part of me, that was a, you know, it was visceral. It wasn't just, and I can speak it perfectly well. I mean, in terms of accent, I make all sorts of grammatical mistakes, but, you know, to hear me, you wouldn't know. And of course, to look at me, you wouldn't know
exactly.
Because I can pass for Greek or Cypriot or Turkish or whatever. So that's my connection to Cyprus.
But then you came back.
And then I came back because, for me, that quarter of a century in the United States was very, very hard. It felt like living in the belly of the beast, and I felt that I had sort of served my time, and I couldn't continue to live there, even though I have two children, two daughters, grown-up daughters now, who are more or less settled there. And I say more or less because one of them spent 8 years living in Lebanon and keeps talking about going back there. I just couldn't, I'd had it. I was done.
You needed to come back to this part of the world.
Yeah. And again, Cyprus was Lebanon adjacent. It was the Mediterranean. It's a, you know.
It's a stone throw away.
It's
a stone throw away. You can actually shout and maybe someone will hear you in Lebanon.
Yes.
The proximity is very close.
Yes, and you know the climate is and the topography is one that moves me in a way that I've never been moved by American landscapes. I mean, I can recognize that they're beautiful, but they don't move me. And I think, you know, the geography one grows up with is, you know, is very much part of one's sort of intrinsic self. And everything about Cyprus, even though obviously it's not perfect, suits me. It's quiet. The pace of life is much, much, much slower, which suits me. People aren't, you know, wound up in the ways that I found they were in the United States. I'm not constantly anxious about, you know, the next racket and the next rip off, and in the United States, I felt such precarity, such precariousness in terms of my material survival.
But I think that's what drew me to Cyprus. I mean, I lived in South Africa, and then I moved to Greece, and I then moved to Cyprus after divorcing my husband. I moved to Cyprus with a little boy, and I think the smallness of the place, the community, okay, the fact that we live in a conflict zone, yet I'm safe, and my son is too. Even when he was little, at the age of 10, I could send him to the Berypta Rot 2 blocks down, and he was safe. So to me, this, I would hear people around me speak in like the South Africans, are more materialistic than I am. But even the Cypriots here, I find this need to have things so irrelevant. I want my space. I want my little space of home. But I need to know that this feeling of safety, of community, and also the ability to actually disconnect, which is important for me.
Yeah,
I don't always need to be. So to me, this is one of the addictive parts of Cyprus.
You know, there is an intimacy
exactly
in small places. You know, the fact that, you can go in the same day, you know, from Nicosia all the way to the top of the mountains and back and have a lovely day out. You can go to the beach for 2 or 3 hours and refresh yourself and enjoy the sea and come back. You know, America's geography is impossible. Everything is, you know, miles away.
Exactly.
You have to travel. It has to be a project. It has to be at least a weekend if it's, you know. And I love that intimacy. I love that smallness. And I think that it is because it reproduces to some extent what I grew up with. And I'm very imbued with that. And, you know, both my brothers ended up staying in England. One of them has now passed away and the other is still there, you know, 40 years later or whatever. I couldn't do it. I couldn't do the weather. I couldn't do the barely veiled racism. I couldn't do the veneer of, you know, humor, which hid all sorts of snarky, in my view, passive aggressive. I just couldn't do it. I love also, I think something for me that's important is that in places like Lebanon and here, and also in Pakistan to some extent, you know, everything is about relationships, you know, and I'm very relational. So I like to know my dry cleaner and my peritoro person and my frutaria, they recognize me. I recognize them. If my car breaks down in the street in front of the frutaria, three guys come out and help me, you know.
I agree with you. This intimacy and of actually, so or going somewhere and running out of money.
Yes.
And saying, you know what? And saying, no, well, the next time you come,
yeah,
you're paid. I mean, this is the security of knowing that you belong, but not claustrophobically.
Yeah. And of course, you know, you mentioned, you know, there is racism and I am beginning to sense it. But at the same time, I am in admiration of Cyprus and its ability to, I mean, when I first came to Cyprus in 1978, there wasn't a single university here.
Yes.
Not one.
It was just after the invasion.
Yeah. And now there are six. I think it's amazing, you know. And a lot of the university places are taken by people, or not taken, but a lot of the universities welcome people from the global south. There are people, there are black people, there are brown people, there are people from Africa, there are people from Asia. And I really respect that. I really, not just respect that, but I really, I like it and I admire this ability to absorb others, even though I know that it's not without frictions and tensions.
Okay, I still battle a little bit with the racism. I don't know if it's the racism as much as the nationalism. The nationalism does jar that, with me.
That I would say is more difficult for me, especially as some of my, I'm discovering slowly that maybe some of the people who are close friends are actually ethno-nationalists.
I think and that's really the a jar that my hair stands on end when I. Yes. Okay, should we now attempt the thing that is really part of your soul and part of mine? I mean, you live next to the polemical or inferno of Gaza now. And that is partly where your heart is. Tell me how you feel, and then I'll share with you how I feel.
Oh, Magda, how I feel. Oh, my goodness. I feel everything that everybody's feeling. I feel anguished. I have pain. I'm
frustrated.
Horrified. By what is going on. I'm like everybody else, you know, thinking, you know, this can't go on, it's going to stop. I'm listening to the news all the time. I'm consumed by what is going on. And there are moments I have felt lonely, But I'm lucky because I also have friends here who are Palestinian or part Palestinian, and therefore I circulate in different milieus. The sort of Cypriot milieu, the one Cypriot milieu that I circulate in is completely, seemingly completely oblivious. But I have enough friends from the Lebanese community and from the Palestinian Cypriot community and from the Lebanese Cypriot community who are all in solidarity.
Can I interrupt you?
Of course.
I'm very much part of this. All children are my children. So if children are suffering anywhere, it's a pain in my heart. And I remember my sister lives in South Africa still, and very unpoliticized. I don't know. I always tease her, how did we come out of the same family? Very unpoliticized. And we went out for dinner one night, and someone turned around to me and said, I'm glad your little Arab friend's children are dying, because it means we will have less terrorists growing up. I mean, I stepped back and I said, you know what, I'm actually going to stop this conversation, but I just want you to sit and think that you're okay with other people's children dying. I didn't carry on because I knew if I did, and this was within a home, and I was not going to carry on this conversation. And a few days later...
So what did you do, Magda? Did you get up and leave?
And I was being calm because I was being respectful to my sister who has a relationship with these people. But we were invited back 2 days later. And I said to my sister, I'm not going. She said to me, why? I said, I can't sit down with your friend who doesn't have a problem with other people's children dying. She said to me, are you being serious? I said, I'm being absolutely serious. Because we're in my heart, all the children of the world must be okay. I'm not happy when other people's children, I'm also not happy with my children, but I'm not happy when other people's children are being targeted or dying. Mm. A mother in grief is like me. And she looked at me, she totally understood, no, she respected the way I felt, didn't really understand because, as I said, my sister's not politicized, I love her for it, but, and I said, I'm not going. She said to me, but when she came back, she said to me, I was expecting you. I said, tough. I can't sit at the table with someone who does not, is okay with other people's children dying. And actually says it.
Yeah, I mean, I would.
Oh, I was horrified. I heard it and I thought, I'm not listening to this.
But that's dehumanizing people. You know, that's not recognizing the humanity of other people, you know, to be able to reduce them to, oh, they're just going to be terrorists, that, you know, they might as well be animals.
I also I also think sometimes people throw out comments and expect an overreaction, and that's why I chose to say, you know what, I'm stepping back from this conversation, but I really want you to focus on the fact that you are okay with other people's children dying.
Yeah,
because I thought I'm not going to win.
For me, I think it's a lot more raw than it is for you, Magda. You know, because I've lived. You know, I remember 1967 when the June War, what the Israelis called the Six-Day War. Mm. I remember, of course, the many years in Lebanon during our so-called civil war, which was really a proxy war, when, you know, there were Israeli overflights every day. And, of course, you know, Beirut has Palestinian refugee camps. I covered the camps. I covered the Sabra and Shatila massacre.
Yes, I remember reading that, yes.
And so it's a lot more raw for me. I couldn't countenance talking to somebody or anybody saying what you reported was said to you.
I couldn't believe I was hearing it. Okay, I couldn't believe I was hearing it.
And I'm like many people, I think, I don't know how many, you know, people in your circle are in that position. But like other people here in Cyprus, as well as in the States, you know, I've lost not friends, not close friends, no, but people who are acquaintances and who are, you know, neighbors. And you know, I feel the bridges are broken, are cut, because I will not countenance somebody telling me that this isn't genocidal, or that this, you know, this is just to, you know,
we tried to kill Hamas. We tried to
root out, yes, root out, you know, without ever asking themselves, you know, why does this movement exist and why did it come to this and what's been happening for 75 years that, you know, these people are so desperate and how they're still being turfed out of their land and having their trees burnt and having their children arrested and detained and, you know, and on and on and on. And, you know, the journal for which I worked was the Journal of Palestine Studies. So I was steeped in Palestine for 10 years. So it's very raw for me.
I have to tell you that when I was doing my degree in South Africa, and we're talking 100 years ago when I did my my dissertation, because I did a postgraduate degree in international law. Mm-hmm. It was on, and we're talking in the early 80s, mm-hmm. on whether wars of liberation are legitimate or legal under modern mm-hmm. international law, a case mm-hmm. for Palestine. Mm-hmm. And my lecturer, the lecturer who supervised my dissertation, mm-hmm. Was part of the legal team that went to the International Court of Justice.
Oh my God, how exciting.
So, I mean, I know it's really a part of me. I haven't seen it raw the way you've seen it. We've lived through it. Yes, but to me, this injustice has been part of my soul. I don't know for how long. But I do need to disconnect every now and again. As my friend Helenique says to me, girlfriend, you need to debrief occasionally, because I get so fired up. I feel as if my head's going to explode. And I think, you know what?
Well, I keep myself safe. Yeah, I lose sleep over it. And I too, at the very beginning, I did, you know, where I was literally 24 hours a day watching, you know, following the news. I made a decision to, you know, that I listen in the morning to whatever has happened overnight, and I don't read anything before I go to bed that has to do with the situation, because it's too upsetting. And I wake up in the middle of the night and my heart is beating and I'm, you know, I'm running arguments in my head with people who, you know.
And I wish I could say that. And why didn't they say that? It's terrible, these conferences you have in your head.
You know, I don't know if we have time, but I wanted to just say something which I think would interest you, which is that there was a translation project that really helped me during the first 3 months of this terrible, terrible, it's not a war, it's a genocidal campaign on Gaza. And I was working on a book, an Arabic text written by a Palestinian who is now passed away. And it's a sort of genre-bending text because it's neither prose nor poetry. I mean, it's ostensibly prose, but it's extremely poetic. And it purports to be a novel, but it's not a novel because it's not fiction. It's more like a memoir that is mixed in with folklore and history, and it's all kind of interwoven together in the voice of this man who was a five-year-old when the Nakba happened, when 1948 happened. It's really beautiful. It's stunning. And that really nurtured me. You know, working on that was like, it made me feel like I'm doing something, because one of the most difficult parts of this is feeling powerless. You know, I go to protests and I, you know, help people by donating to campaigns, and I, you know, spread the news on social media and blah, blah, blah. But working on this text, which was so beautiful, and again, you know, translation is a very intimate act because you're really intertwined with the mind of another person. It really helped me. It really steadied me. Even though the stories he's telling in this book, you know, are the stories we're watching, different times, different weapons, not this level or scope of, you know, barbarity, but the same. Ethnic cleansing, driving people out of their homes, frightening them, you know, and then barring them from returning and making them into perpetual refugees.
Thank you for that. What I've helped, feel has helped me is I've spoken to all my Palestinian and Israeli network for people that speak reconciliation. And I've said to them, you know, I've got a podcast, that's all I can offer you. But if you, because I know especially the Palestinian women are battling to get their story out. They're battling to be heard. And I've said to them all, you know what, let me know, put it on there, even if it's just to get you to speak, allow you the safe space of speaking for 45 minutes. This is what I can offer. And I mean, even though they're heartbreaking to listen to, I also find they're therapeutic for me, because I feel as if I'm reaching out or I'm offering an embrace.
Yes.
And because we're running out of time, how can we end this without being too morose? Because morose doesn't do any of us any good.
Well, I'm not morose. I mean, I think it's what's going on is hallucinating.
Morose is perhaps the wrong word. Awful. I think maybe morose is the wrong word. I think there's a lot of despair. I feel despair at the level of, or the lack of humanity.
Yes. I understand that, and that's what I feel. But at the same time, I take heart from listening to Palestinians themselves describe what is going on as, although it is unfathomably awful, as the crucible of something new, as being, this is a historical turning point. And I've certainly listened to very thoughtful analysts who don't think this is the end of the Palestinian story. On the contrary, I have a hard time with that, because, you know, I think to myself, you know, how are we gonna, you know, how are we gonna do this? But I'm not a politician, you know, and so, you know, I take refuge in my short stories and novels, and, you know, which are beautiful in their language and in their abundance and in their softness and embrace of life.
I think the one thing that gives me a bit of hope is that even though, besides the people that have passed away, the biggest victim of this conflict is the middle road, is the left in both communities, Israeli and the Palestinian. I want to believe, and I've heard it being said, that there's a lot of dissent within Israel about the leadership. And what we knew of October the 6th in Israel is not what's going to emerge out of this conflict. And it's going to be a more unifying one. So I'd like you, inshallah, I agree. The times that I think, how is this going to happen? Because there's been so much rage and death and extremes.
And barbarity and savagery. I mean, it's hard to come back from savagery.
And I think of how are they going to come together? And I can't really see a vision, but I want to believe that there is a positive vision ahead, that there will be a space where this barbarity does no longer exist.
I hope so. Time will tell, Magda.
Time will tell. We have to keep on raising their voices. Not raising their voices, giving space for their voices, or repeating what they have said and get the message further out, because I think the global community, there is hope within, not hope, there is support within the global community.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, you know, this isn't the space to do it, but I mean, you know, one could spend a whole hour, you know, analyzing what is happening in Palestine. And I'm going to call it Palestine and not Israel, is a reflection of a broader world, which is still neocolonial, which is extractive capitalism, which is,
So I want to believe that at least our children will have gone past the stage where the capitalism to its extreme, that money always talks.
Mm-hmm.
I want to believe at some stage.
Weapons manufacturing. I mean, can you imagine how much money the weapons manufacturers of the world have made? I mean, the stock market shows you. It's really awful. I mean, it's awful that we live in a world where, you know, it's taken for granted that this is the way things are, that, you know, this is modernity, you know, that, yeah, it's a pity, but we have stock exchanges and we have arms manufacturers and we have...
It's not only the arms manufacturers, it's the control of resources. I mean, this thing of if you control the money, you control the world. So I want to believe that us little people at some stage will find a way to live together without being imposed upon by the Netanyahu, Erdogan, Biden's, Putin's of the world.
Yeah.
To name just a few of them, because there are a lot more. And yes. I'll add to them the Donald Trumps and the Bill Gates and the Amazons of the world. Okay.
Yes.
So let's live in hope, because if we don't have hope, we have nothing left. So let's send a message of hope and solidarity.
Sounds good to me.
To the people like the Palestinians, because to the Palestinians you can add the Yemenis, the Syrians, the Ukrainians, the Sudanese, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So
let's send out
a message of solidarity to the people whose only crime is wanting a life of dignity.
Yes, I think you're a better person than I am. My view is just burn it all down.
Okay.
You know, I don't think that Western imperialist capitalism, extractive capitalism, which has been the story of Western imperialism for the last 400 years, I don't think it's salvageable or redeemable. That's my view. So, you know, for me, burn it all down.
I think you're being more honest than me. I'm trying to be utopic, whereas you're being more realistic.
You're being utopian.
So I agree with you that I don't think it's salvageable. I think it's got to be totally burn it down and build something new that is inclusive.
And because that, of course, everyone is to survive climate catastrophe, which we might not, which probably would be a good thing. Because
Because all everyone is looking for is to be able to live a life with dignity. That is all that everyone wants. It's as simple as that. Okay, so we're going to get through this. When it burns down, we will back a better world.
And they want more than a life of dignity, I have to tell you. But yes, I think most of us, most of the little people in the world want just a life of dignity. I agree. And certainly, the Palestinians want.
And the little people are more than the big people, the strong people. So we must remember that there's power in numbers.
There's more of us than there is of them.
Exactly, and we need to remember that. And I think we could carry on talking forever, but I think let's remember that there's more of us than of them.
Yes.
So we need to fight work for our right to have a life of dignity.
I agree.
Our neighbors around us, not personally, communally
wise. Yes, of course. All of us. All humans.
All humans.
Yeah.
Thank you for a very interesting conversation,
Maya.
Thank
you so much for giving me this chance. I've never done a podcast, so I'm thrilled.
And maybe we can also get together off the air so we can have a longer unrestrained conversation.
Yeah.
less time restrained conversation.
Yes.
So Maya, thank you for being with us. as we said, we're sending out a message of solidarity to remind people that there are more of us than there are of them. So our right to a life of dignity is something we must continue striving for as a community. Yes. And to the listeners, thank you for listening and stay along with us to fight for a life that we all want, life of dignity. Thank you. And have a good rest of the day.
Thanks, Magda. Same to you.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus, Island Talks. Open, diverse, free.